Of the Linux Show. We do this every Tuesday night. It's going to be our normal show, and we've got some special things going on that are a little bit unexpected. Just about 5 minutes before the show started, Eric Raymond called up, so we're going to have Eric as a guest on the show tonight. It's a little bit of a surprise, but we'll see what the news from Eric is all about. But we decided to do something a little bit different this week, and that is that we are going to have a little bit of an extended show. Last week, of course, we had some technical difficulties. In fact, it was a total train wreck. And what we're hoping to do tonight is to make up some of that lost ground. I know some of you are already in the IRC, and you've already noticed that we've got a bunch of people already lined up at in the IRC. Our guest from last week, Chris, is going to be talking to us about the Chris Perillo experience. That's the only thing I can call it at this point. A pretty crazy guy with everything that's happening over at Locker Gnome and Gnome Dex and all the news from Chris Perillo. And plus, we've added on a third segment tonight. So now with Eric, boy, we're going to have really four spots on tonight's show. So let's go ahead and introduce the whole crew. Doc, you're here tonight, aren't you?
I'm here. I'd hate to come on and say I'm not here, but I'm here. Yeah. Yeah. I showed up for the train wreck last week. As I recall, I didn't read my email, so I didn't know when the wreck was.
Nobody else showed up for the train wreck but you did.
You sounded pretty stressed.
It was. It's funny how, I should say it's not very funny at all, actually, but it's bizarre how it always happens that the equipment sits there running, and people pick up streams all week long. And so the equipment runs all week long. And there's constantly people hitting the server. But it never fails. Whenever we have a really major technical problem, it always happens, an hour or two before showtime. And we're always put in this position of having to run to Radio Shack to try and fix it, which is literally what happened last week. I just didn't have enough time to put the pieces back together again. But we're here again. So how are you doing, Doc?
I'm doing great. I'm doing great. I'm fooling around with doing the IRC thing and this at the same time, which is like, for a kind of a born ADD case like me, is like, my brain is falling apart.
Well, what you need to do is get yourself a good headset telephone.
I have that. You're hearing a headset right now.
Well, then you're in business.
So I'm a two-handed guy, but I need to be a four-lobed guy, I think, or something like that. Anyway, no, we're doing really well here. There's a lot of interesting stuff going on around Linux Journal. A lot of interesting things we're following. Nothing that's at the top of the news. I don't want to impinge on that because the list is so long of the stuff we want to cover. But and it's perfect right now. And since you know we're past the June gloom time in Santa Barbara, July came and the sun came out and it's hot. I mean, hot, not as hot as where Arnie is, of course. You know, but nothing beats that. I guess a few things beat that, but not by much.
You could go to Death Valley, I suppose.
You could go to Death Valley, but Valley, you know, it's just over the ridge there. But, you know, it gets up to the 80s here, and people start complaining. But it's nice. It's really nice. And you know, I'm going next week to the open source convention. I don't know if the rest of you guys are hitting that guy.
I'll be there.
Yeah, it'll be great. It'll be a good show.
And we're going to have an announcement.
Oh, you will?
Yes.
We being?
The Open Source Initiative.
Excellent.
We're going to have a major announcement, which I can't talk about right now.
So why are you talking about it?
Because he knows how to drum it up. It's great.
Yeah,
see how he is?
This is foreplay, for God's sakes.
Yeah.
Eric, let's not invite Eric anymore. He just teases.
No, he just treated us like a John.
Yeah, right.
Like a what? Like a John.
And we didn't even get kissed.
That's okay. Christmas is foreplay too, you know.
Yeah. Well, how are you doing, Arnie?
Oh, I'm doing fine. It's Doc says, the Inland Empire here. It's like 15 to 20 degrees warmer than where Doc is, because we're here between two mountain ranges on the inland side, and it is decidedly desert-like. And the rain, around early June, the rain stops happening. It stays cloudy for June, called the June gloom, but then when that goes away, the sun comes out, and basically you don't see any clouds until about winter, and then maybe you'll see a couple. It basically hasn't rained here in years, you know, but occasionally it'll drop, a few drops will come down. It's miserable.
Interesting tease.
It's very miserable here right now. You can have it.
Shall I issue a more interesting tease?
Sure.
Go ahead, Eric. If you ever thought, gee, wouldn't it be nice if the open source community had something like the Oscars?
Oh.
Be paying careful attention on July 10th.
All right. Is this like the Webbies? Sounds cool.
Hmm. Yeah, well, I complained to the Linux Journal, about a month ago, because, Doc, you guys just announced the nominations for the Linux Journal's Best of Product Lists. Oh, when was it? It was about a month ago.
Hmm.
And I commented to the woman at Linux Journal who's putting it together that they really need to broaden the scope of the awards that they hand out. I know you don't want to dilute them too much, but there's a lot of grunts out there who really work their tail off that, you know, they don't get noticed. You know, they don't get best product of the year type things, but they're equally deserving of some very serious recognition, and maybe their role is nothing more than clerical, but still, you know, the open source community is a community, and there's lots of people filling lots of different very, very important roles, and it all needs to get done.
Well, one of the things that we've been covering, it's in this issue, in the current issue I wrote about it, and it really leverages to some degree what Eric wrote a while ago about use value rather than sale value software, is that all the action with Linux is happening on the demand side. I mean, what's really interesting is, I mean, if you look at what, I don't want to pick on Microsoft here, but it's interesting that they treat Linux as if it was a vendor instead of a project by its customers to a large degree. It's something that the demand side does. It's one of the things that happens when the demand side starts supplying itself, and if you just look at what's happening on the demand side, it's almost mathematical. Like, let's factor out the supply side for a second. Let's factor out vendors for a minute and see what the market looks like. If you're looking only at what's happening inside companies and governments and enterprises of all sizes, and some of it involves vendors, but an awful lot of it doesn't. And the interesting thing, though, is it's kind of hard to find those people. You know, very often I'll hear from them. I mean, like, for example, I was hearing from Real Networks for years that they were doing cool stuff with Linux, but please don't quote me on this, and I'm writing with my Yahoo account or some other thing like that, you know.
Yeah.
I can think of one really big company that did not make it in that particular piece, even though the place is not only full of Linux, they have policies about, they have toolkits, they have all kinds of things. It's very highly developed what they're doing with open source and free software, but they don't want to talk about it at all.
Because it's a competitive edge for them.
Well, it isn't even a competitive edge thing. It's just paranoia, you know? And here's one I can talk about. Verizon. Verizon's rolling out all kinds of really cool stuff in New York, at the top of which is Wi-Fi base stations in all of the phone booths. Okay, little phone booth on the corner. It's got a Verizon Wi-Fi base station in there. They did all of their development on Linux.
For the next 3 minutes, please deposit 15 quarters.
No, just if you. But one of the ways that they've done it is so that, and the way they developed it using Linux and other open source tools was that if they want to change the business model, which right now it's basically a freebie for DSL customers. If you're a Verizon DSL customer, you get to leave your home, and you now have cordless DSL through these phone booths everywhere. But if they want to switch that off and say, well, we want to give it free to everybody, or we want to add the mobile guys, or we got a partnership now with so-and-so, and so we're willing to add, say, Boingo customers to this, they can do that relatively easily. And the threshold of deployment is so low because they did all the development with Linux. Now, the interesting thing is that they don't necessarily have Linux yet in the data center, but they didn't do this in the data center. They did this elsewhere. And I don't know, I may be talking a little bit out of school because some of this not so much NDA, but they don't want to advertise what they're doing inside the company that much. But they were willing to say that they were able to deploy very quickly by avoiding vendors, basically, and doing all of this stuff on their own using Linux.
Oh, boy, is that a frightening wake-up call for the IT industry.
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah, and if you look at the current story that it's in the July Linux Journal, it's about a 4,000-word piece. I spent months talking to IT guys at big companies. Roland Smith at LSI Logic was one that I got quoted, and a guy named Leon Chisholm, who is absolutely fearless at Orbitz, which is a big travel company, invented from scratch, by the way, by the big airlines, all Linux. And when I said, what I'm getting is that the vendors are largely being led by the customers. He said that's a total understatement. we're leading the show here. But the vendors aren't leading the show. Yet if you read the Wall Street Journal, the New York Times, the story they tell is, it's all IBM and HP. Well, no, it's not. It's the customers. And I'm looking for more customer heroes.
And it always has been.
Well, it always has been, but
and that's the thing that Microsoft has never gotten. It's always been those ISPs out in the trenches that were the early adopters and also the early kernel hackers.
Yep.
It's always been the customers, and yeah. Microsoft has never gotten that fast. It's not.
Well, I don't want to damn them completely here. They actually had a lot. I've seen them do a lot of very customer-centric stuff. I think where they went off the rails really big time last summer was when they did what only a monopolist could do, which is when you have 100% of the market, you just simply raise the prices. When not a single customer asked for that.
Licensing six.
Yeah.
Yeah. And that, and they learned the hard way on that one, because that pissed off a lot of people. Who weren't pissed off, necessarily, to begin with.
Another good example of the demand side pulling on things is the CELF announcement.
Today. Yeah, that's a good way to leverage over to that one.
Yeah, everybody know about this?
I think it's on our list. I think, isn't there a link? I don't know if there is or not.
It might be. I don't know. I haven't been in.
Yeah, basically,
you just go to Google News and find it.
Every big consumer electronics company in the world got together and said, we're going to push Linux for all of our consumer electronics and embedded devices.
This is a big story.
It's a huge story. And an interesting thing is that this is the first shoe dropped when, I forget his last name, but a guy named Ando something or other gave the second keynote at CES last winter. And at that time it was Sony and Matsushita and Hitachi and Toshiba and Philips, I think. But a lot of other guys got added as of today.
Listen to this list.
Today.
Matsushita, which is Panasonic, Sony, Hitachi, NEC, Philips, Samsung, Sharp, of course, and Toshiba. Woof! This is major, major stuff.
So there's about 3 square feet of the island of Japan that is not participating.
That's right.
Right.
Linux is now the new VHS.
Well, it's not only the VHS.
That's a great line. I like that.
This is big stuff.
Was that you, Eric?
No.
Who said it's the new VHS?
Me, Jeff.
Jeff, okay, Jeff, you get the quote.
Quote me.
This is the Consumer Electronics Linux Forum, CELF, and they announced the announcement is 8 of the world's largest consumer electronics manufacturers sent a strong signal Tuesday that Linux has a future in their markets.
Well, seeing as we're going to talk about this anyways, and it really is, Eric, couldn't agree with you more for bringing it up because it is a big story for consumer electronics. Something that sort of was buzzing around in the back of my head while I was reading that story, and maybe I'm putting my own spin on things because I do that, but you think that all this might also be not only a message to our competitive software producer in Redmond, Washington, but you think it might have been sort of a wake-up call as well to the people in the intellectual property industries?
No, I think it's much simpler than either of those explanations.
You think it's just cheap nails and boards?
The simplest explanation is that when you're manufacturing consumer electronics at that kind of volume, volumes are huge, margins are razor thin, and if there's any source of costs, like proprietary software licenses, that can be eliminated, you want to do that.
That's a cheap nails board.
Yeah.
And here's a good example of how that works. When my wife got a 1992 Infiniti Q45, this is new, a $45,000 car. The next, in 1994 or 5, I forget which, they decontented, this is a new term that they had at that time, they decontented a bunch of extraneous things. One of the things they cut out was AM stereo. The part, I found out, cost 5 cents.
And this is an automobile.
In a $45,000 automobile. And it was a total value subtract, as far as I mean, in a luxury car, they cut out AM stereo. In fact, a lot of those guys cut out AM stereo.
Is anybody broadcasting AM stereo?
Yeah, they are, especially in Los Angeles. You can pick them up. They sound great. KNX, the news station, is in stereo. Sounds great.
Let me tell you, I just drove through Missouri, and AM is alive and well out in the country.
Yeah.
You know, there's an interesting thing about that. I read an article about this, and whether you like him or hate him, apparently Rush Limbaugh has been credited with single-handedly keeping AM radio alive.
Well, and
Rush, and it's ESPN.
And news radio in general, but certainly Rush Limbaugh has given that
benefit. He deserves a lot of credit.
Yeah, well.
And so do the sports stations, the ESPN and Sporting News and those guys.
Yep. So Disney owns now about 1/3 of AM radio. Is that what we're getting at?
Just major markets. It's actually them and Clear Channel.
Yeah, sports talk and news, it's a natural for AM because for that, you know, who needs fidelity? Our ears are very good at compensating.
Yeah.
You just got get yourself a crane, a CC crane radio, and tune in the world on AM.
Has anybody here checked out the new satellite radio digital service?
I've barely, but
MX1, I think it's called.
Oh, it's a data service.
No, it's
you're not talking about XM and Sirius, are you?
XM. Oh yeah, that's it. XM.
Yeah.
Well, I can give you a little heads up about XM. We may be broadcasting on XM in the not too distant future.
Interesting.
Whoa.
I went through their channel list and I found the one they programmed for me. And that's a tiny niche market. I found the one they programmed for ex-musicians who like to listen to a mixture of intelligent metal, progressive jazz, and instrumental rock.
That's good.
Wow.
Yeah, well, I told them that if they had a jazz, techno music, and geek talk channel, they would do well. And they've actually downloaded a number of our shows, and this is way ahead of the cart right now, but over the course of the next 6 months, they don't do any new programming for another 6 months, but over the course of the next 6 months, we're going to be producing some special samples just for XM Radio.
What's interesting isn't the fact that they happen to program a channel for me. It's that they have enough channels that they can afford to define and explore market niches as small as the one I fit in.
Yeah, the problem, from what I've heard of them, is that it's still very top-down. It's still a lot of the same old radio guys doing what they did in 1985, which is, you know, we're going to tell you what you need to hear. But they are able to slice it about 50 different ways, which is nice, because you turn on the commercial band and it's sliced about 4 different ways.
Yeah. Well, also, Doc, as the technology improves, when you've got devices like the management tool that's now in development by Radio Paradise, where you've got the potential for putting an interactive song selection tool rather than people driving down a highway on a satellite radio calling and making requests, they may do it with their BlackBerry unit built into the dashboard.
Now that's cool.
Okay, so it's really not that far off. It really isn't. It's never going to be content on demand when you're talking about a broadcast model. But, you know, if you've got, you know, 15 people on their BlackBerry unit saying play more techno, they're going to play more techno. You know, it's a logical thing to do. So it's really interesting how that XM business model is evolving. I've been watching it very closely. In fact, we've got a number of listeners out there on the Linux show who actually I do owe kudos to for queuing me into the people at XM and giving me the names of a vice president to talk to. It's amazing that little, you know, 6 degrees of separation. Got to credit our listeners for contacting XM and saying, "Hey, get the Linux show on your network." So that's pretty cool. But we are running a little tight on time. Eric, do you want to make any more announcements?
No. Should I talk about the FCO development yet?
Yeah, talk about SCO.
Okay, well, there's a famous Arthur Conan Doyle line about how the most significant thing that happened was the dog did not bark in the night. Well, the most significant thing that has happened in the FCO lawsuit imbroglio in the last week is the fact that when FCO filed its amended complaint, it did not seek a temporary restraining order. Now, in order to understand why this is significant, you have to know what a temporary restraining order is, under what circumstances they're granted, under what circumstances they're not granted. You seek a temporary restraining order when you have an argument that the plaintiff's conduct the person you're suing, the conduct of the person you're suing, is likely to do irreparable harm to your business, and there is no substantial likelihood that they can prevail on the merits of the case. So, the fact that they didn't seek a TRO means that in their model of the situation, either IBM is not doing them irreparable harm, or they don't think that the judge is going to feel that they're likely to prevail on the merits of the case, therefore he won't issue a TRO. So this is a signal that that FCO knows that its case is weak.
Sure.
So that's the major interesting development. You and the Linux Show's listeners can also be the first people to hear that Rob Landley and I are working on a line-by-line refutation of that complaint, which at some point we will probably publish.
Paragraph by paragraph, actually. With lots of links.
Yes. Rob, you need to talk up, Rob.
Paragraph by paragraph, actually, with lots of links. Hi, I'm Rob. I used to write for The Motley Fool. I've done a whole lot of this stuff, and I have a huge research file that I've been going through and sort of annotating why this proved them wrong and why that proved them wrong. And it's a lot of work. They make a lot of spurious claims.
And in many cases, however, we find that we can quote their own press releases and their own 10-Ks and 10-Qs to refute what they're now saying.
It helps to be able to read Securities and Exchange Commission filings and financial statements and know where to find them. From Caldera, from Tarantella, from Novell. I even managed to quote one from Microsoft once that was relevant.
Cool.
I have a question.
The party that I'm not good at. He knows how to read the financial statements.
Yeah. Is somebody asked me, I have no idea the answer to this question, is BSD also at risk of SCO's?
They've made statements that say, basically, if we can come up with an excuse to sue BSD, to sue Berkeley, we will. It's almost certainly more FUD. They're basically just trying to make rattle the sword as much as possible and say, nobody's safe unless they pay us.
Have we been through why the history of BSD is relevant? Did I cover the
right point? No, not here.
Okay. The reason the history of BSD is relevant is because FCO's rights in the System 5 source code are substantially impaired by a lawsuit settlement in 1993. The history of that is that there came a point at which AT&T decided that BSD was competition that it didn't like and sued them on alleged copyright, trademark, and trade secret violations. And what happened was the BSD people did a code audit, came back around and said, wait a second, you have misappropriated a whole bunch of BSD code. You've incorporated it in your Release 4 product, which is okay, but you have stripped off the licenses and the attributions, which is not okay, so we're going to sue you. And these lawsuits both ended up in the same courtroom in New Jersey, and the judge issued some very interesting and juicy findings, which were subsequently sealed, but some of them are now available, among other places, on Dennis Ritchie's homepage. And among other things, he said that he found that there was a substantial likelihood that BSD would prevail on the merits, that there was a question as to whether AT&T even had valid copyrights in the code anymore, and then let alone trade secrets. And he then basically said to the contending parties, get the hell out of my courtroom and settle. Now, while this was going on, the ownership of the source code base actually changed hands twice.
once, the ownership of the AT&T code base, not the Berkeley code base.
That's right. Once from AT&T to Unix Systems Labs, and then from Unix Systems Labs to Novell, and at the point where the judge said, get the hell out of my courtroom and settle, it was actually in Novell's hands. And Novell and BSD did settle, and under the terms of the settlement, the BSD had to mark some files in the BSD distribution with AT&T copyrights, and it had to remove and replace three source code files.
Basically, what Berkeley did is it came out with a cleaned up BSD release. This was a BSD Reno.
Reno 4.3.
Reno. that basically Novell certified was not AT&T intellectual property. It belonged solely to Berkeley. They could do whatever the heck they wanted with it.
Right, and so under the terms of the settlement, both Novell and all of its successors in interest were forbidden from asserting proprietary rights over what was in the BSD code. And the result is, to the extent that what's in System 5 Release 4 overlaps with what's in BSD, SCO cannot claim proprietary rights over that code.
Because remember, the System 5 people were incorporating a lot of BSD code, so the fact that the BSD code was certified as not belonging to AT&T doesn't mean it doesn't overlap. It means the System 5 people couldn't claim they wrote it. They probably sucked it in from Berkeley.
Yeah. So the upshot is, this is why SCO is now making noises about BSD supposedly not having lived up to its obligations under the 1993 settlement.
Because it undermines the heck out of their case if they can't throw some kind of shadow of doubt over Berkeley.
That's right.
Well, but in the meantime, they're trying to throw a shadow of doubt over the rest of the Unices as well.
They're just spewing BS in all directions.
This doesn't make any sense at all.
It does. If you follow the money, the last big thing that SCO did that got them a lot of money was suing Microsoft over Dr. Dot.
Yeah.
The old digital research product.
Yeah, digital research
product. If you look at their SEC filing, they got over $150 million settlement from Microsoft. And on the strength of that, they got $30 million of venture capital investment and had an IPO that got them 60-something million, bringing the total up to about $250 million. That's what they bought SCO's operating system division with, and that's what's been funding them for 3 years. And now that the money's run out, they're basically going, well, what did we do last time that got us a heap of cash? We sued somebody with deep pockets over an ancient piece of proprietary garbage that was obsolete that we bought off a corpse. Let's do it again. So they're suing over System 5.
Oh, wow. Unfortunately, Linux is involved.
Yes.
Well, Caldera was a Linux company. In 1994, they shipped Linux for, what, 8 years?
They're still shipping Linux.
They still have it up. They withdrew it so that they're not selling it anymore. They're still complying with the terms of the GPL. At some point, they're probably going to start trying to claim that the GPL doesn't apply to them because, well, if it does apply to them, hey, you shipped the code. If you didn't audit what you shipped, that's your problem, not ours. If you shipped your own code on your own website and you're blaming somebody else for putting it in there, but you shipped it, you're kind of screwed. So at some point, they're probably going to have to attack the GPL, but that's highly unlikely to do much good because they submitted the GPL in one of their Securities and Exchange Commission filings. S-1 thing when they did their IPO, they submitted a copy of the GPL to the Securities and Exchange Commission. How the heck are they supposed to say, hey, we didn't know. We just sent it off to the Fed. Right.
It warms my black heart.
It's the tip of the iceberg. I mean, there's a reason that we've been annotating this. We've been rebutting this complaint for 2 weeks now, and I'd say I'm about two-thirds done.
Yeah. If this is going to be comprehensive.
Lots of research, lots of links.
Sounds like fun.
Well, I wouldn't exactly call it fun, but it's necessary.
Reading Microsoft Securities and Exchange Commission filings is probably somebody's definition of fun, but not mine. But it's useful work.
And useful. The product's useful, too.
Yep,
absolutely. Well, we are 35 after the hour, and Eric, you guys are more than welcome to hang out if you'd like to. We're going to be taking a short break now and jumping into segment two. We've got a guest waiting for the next segment, but you're more than welcome to hang out if you like. And regardless, the guest who is our guest in segment three, starting at 9 o'clock, if not tonight, I would certainly like to get you, Eric, in touch with Chris Perillo sometime. I think you guys would have an interesting debate. Chris, Russ, and I just
How long did that series of emails go back and forth, Russ? About a solid week and a half, I suppose.
Yeah.
Chris is a hard sell. He's a hard sell. He thinks Linux is a good thing, but he has some preconceived notions that appears on what open source really is. And I think someone like you might you might enjoy having a chat with a guy like Chris. So we'll try and hook that up in the future. But Kevin, why don't you put us on a little break, put on a commercial, put on a song, put on something, and we'll take a short break and come back with segment number two of this extended version of the Tuesday night edition of the Linux Show for July the 1st, 2003. We'll be back in about 3 or 4 minutes, everybody.
I'm a glum one, it's explainable, I'm at someone, unattainable, life's a bore, the world is my oyster no more. All the papers where I led the news, with my capers, now we'll spread the news. Superman turned out to be flash in the pan. I've flown around the world in a plane. I settle revolutions in Spain. The North Pole I have charted. Still I can't get started with you. On the golf course I'm under par. And all the movies ask me to star. Got a house that's a showplace. Still I get no place with you. You're so supreme. Lyrics I write of you scheme. Just for the sight of you dream. Both day and night of you. But what good does it do? I've been consulted by Franklin D. And Greta Garbo had me to tea. Still I'm brokenhearted, 'cause I can't get started with you.
When I sell kisses at a bazaar, the wolves line up from nearby and far. With kings I've a la carte, but still I can't get started with you. The millionaires I have to turn down would stretch from London to New York town. The upper crust I visit, but say, what is it with you? Oh, tell me why am I no kick to you? I who'd always stick to you. And fit to you. Tell me why I'm taboo. Though beauty columns ask my advice, though I was Miss America twice, still you've got me outsmarted, 'cause I can't get started.
several jazz clubs, I've been a star. Even put new strings on my guitar. So many tunes I've charted, still I can't get started with you. Across the ping pong table, I'm feared. I even grew this wonderful beard. I come on like a swinger, but you don't let me linger with you. I play in tune. My beat is reliable when I croon. The ladies get sighable, but when it's June, it's undeniable. I get winter from you. I've been consulted by Richie C. On every tune, I'm in the right key. My hair is neatly parted.
Still, I can't get started.
And we're back.
This is the Lennox Show for July the 1st, 2003. Hope you guys out there listening to the show aren't suffering too much. We're sorry about the drop in quality of the signal this week. We'll have it all patched back together again by next week. We just didn't quite get the equipment put together the way we wanted to this week, but it was at least stable enough so that we could get on the air, so we decided not to mess with it too much after we got it working earlier today. So hopefully the signal will sound a lot better come next week. We're going to try digging up some old modems to make a voice processor out of, unfortunately, the quote-unquote modern technology that's out there. Sort of sucks when it comes to the external analog devices, just the ability to switch microphone ports and speaker ports. Our newfangled technology just is not as good as some of the older analog ISA-based stuff that was out there a few years ago, so it makes it a little difficult for us to do the crazy mix of analog technology and digital technology that we use to mix all this stuff together. I suppose it would be a hell of a lot easier if we just went out and spent $1,000 on the Gentry unit, but we'll keep on working in the direction that we are until a sponsor steps forward with $1,000 and puts us into the big leagues of online broadcasters. But until then, just a little heads up. I know we didn't get into much of the news, just a story or two. Don't panic. Segment one, number one, was sort of bumped into a segment number four because we wanted to allow Eric some time to talk about his topic. So we're going to try and stick to a fairly tight schedule tonight. For the next 15, 20 minutes or so, we're going to be talking our segment number two to Tim Pozar. Tim, welcome to the Lennox Show.
Thank you.
And we're going to talk about wireless. Well, Tim, first of all, let's start out with the easy stuff. Why don't you tell everybody about your involvement in BAWUG and some of the things you've done in the broadcast industry as your background, and then let's just talk about Wi-Fi.
Oh, sure, yeah. I've been a broadcast engineer since 74 or so. So it's been doing it for a little bit.
So and you know what a Gentner unit is, then.
Yeah, I do, exactly. I've bought many of them. there's a couple other manufacturers out there that you can use, too. Anyway, so I've been doing broadcast engineering for ages. One of the principles, if I can get into this, of my life has been trying to help people communicate, and at least putting the technological infrastructure in there so that, that folks can do it. And to that end, I've started a number of community radio stations, and back when community radio stations were seen as a great democratizer for communications. And then, of course, everybody started buying up that, and that's become one giant monopoly, as you were talking about earlier. And then I wrote code that connected FidoNet up to the Internet. I don't know if you remember FidoNet.
Oh, sure.
And wrote BBS code and started the first ISP in San Francisco, which is called TLGNet, or Little Garden.
Well, as an old ISP guy, do you remember WWA?
Oh, yeah.
Okay. Yeah. Kevin and I were two of the honchos at WWA.
Oh, okay. Great.
So we're co-internet geeks, huh?
you may remember TLGNet.
Oh, I do. Absolutely.
Oh, okay. Good.
Absolutely remember it.
So we did that, and let's see, what else am I doing? Oh, so the bit lately is wireless. It seems to be, well, of course, the Internet was the great democratizer, but getting that to folks has been tough in some regards to economically depressed areas or like, for instance, I did a lot of work at a Native American reservation up in the Dakotas, and they're just, you know, no way this sort of technology is going to get to them because they're just out in the middle of nowhere. And wireless is going to be that technology that's going to leapfrog into there.
And then you can do it with a Pringles can.
You can do it. Well, that's one of the nice things about the commoditization of 802.11 is not only can you do it with Pringles cans, but you can do it with a $60 transmitter as opposed to a $600,000 transmitter or a $60,000 transmitter, whatever. So it's dropped the price point at least by 100, if not 1,000 fold, of being able to do very high-speed communications. So, directions on this. So lately, I guess I'm on Baywalk. I helped co-found a users group called Bay Area Wireless Users Group. Matt Peterson actually was a principal founder to that. And I came in, I guess, one of the folks that had a clue at that point along the lines of the RF and legal side of things coming from my broadcast career, whereas everybody else was kind of more on the ones and zeros sort of thing. And we were waiting around for folks to start up a network around San Francisco, and so far nobody did it, and so we just said, well, let's do it. So we started, I founded a network called Bay Area Research Wireless Network, or BARN, as in like barn raising and things like that. And we're putting up access points on top of mountaintops all around the Bay Area to address not only the last mile or first mile, or however you view it, but the second to the last mile issue, because most people who want to put in like a neighborhood access point or an access point to feed their neighborhood have to deal with the appropriate use policies of the DSL or the broadband provider that they're plugging into, and usually that those broadband providers are very restrictive about you being able to do that.
Tim, a quick question. When I was talking to the NYC wireless guys in New York a couple of weeks ago, they were telling me they had a really hard time, not so much getting roof rights, but getting the price down on roof rights, because the landowners or the building owners were used to dealing with deep-pocketed guys that were willing to pay a lot for cell and for broadcast and for other things like that. Have you encountered a similar problem there?
Actually, I'm going about it a little bit different way. What we're doing is, and I could go in a little more detail about how the barn stuff works, but we're going to public safety agencies who usually have communication sites for their two-way and such, and say, listen, public safety has very little bandwidth usually attributed or given to them to be able to move data back and forth in the field. We're going to bring you, you know, 11 megabits in reality, like 5 megabits worth of bandwidth, so you can actually do streaming video and such. Just let us put our equipment up there, and we'll trade you bandwidth. So that's kind of how we've been approaching it. And so far, we've been relatively successful in getting a hold of the folks that we need to in city and county government to be able to put our stuff up. That's our answer?
That's a good answer.
Yeah, okay.
Yeah, it's an excellent answer.
So to that, we actually have we have a number of objectives at the Barnes stuff, and one is coming back from my my wireless, or excuse me, my internet sort of side of things, and my FidoNet sort of side of things, is that I don't know if anybody remembers back in the TLG days, but there was the backbone was run by ARPANET and then eventually NSF, and the backbone was restricted on what sort of traffic you could put over it at that time. So when TLGNet started, we decided not to have any appropriate use policies. Any traffic was fine going over this thing. We wanted to see ourselves as more common carrier as opposed to going down that slippery slope of censoring what traffic is going over it. So we're deploying this wireless network so that anybody can plug into it. Any anonymous user can just point a dish up and plug into it. They may have to log in as like guest, you know, or something like that, but they can log in and start using it. Well, we also want to be able to ensure that members, you know, people who contribute like money or hardware or time to this thing, can also get access to it. So what we're doing is bandwidth shaping. So as a guest logs into it, they may have as much bandwidth as they can get, as long as a member doesn't start eating up bandwidth and start moving, taking up chunks of bandwidth out of that pipe. And of course, we're trying to address public safety as well, so public safety has the highest tier. So if they log in, they get all the bandwidth that they need. People don't get bumped off, but they'll just notice that their connection just gets slower and slower as the higher tier users start using the bandwidth.
So the free guys can get on. They just have a very low priority.
Right. And again, if members or public safety isn't using it, they can use as much as they want. They can, you know, use that 5 megabits or whatever, because we're deploying right now 802.11b.
What tool are you using to do the bandwidth shaping?
We're experimenting with DummyNet right now to play with that. We're kind of a FreeBSD house right now. So all of our stuff is we're using kind of tools that like AskGraph and things like that are based on FreeBSD.
You ought to take a look at Sputnik.
I know David Sifry very well. and we've been talking to him as well.
Yeah, Dave's a great guy and he's got a good product.
Yeah. He's been very supportive of this network as well. So we'll use any tool. I mean, it's just the reason we're using FreeBSD is that we know the developers pretty well along the lines of the driver developers and such. So if we need something, it's relatively easy to get something fixed. We're not quite as clued in on the Linux community.
A couple questions I have for you right off the top. As you were doing this, did you contact many of the other people out there, like in New York City, and there's a number of other isolated places around the country where people have started to put up community free nets? Have you talked to anybody else and trying to, you know, learn from other people's previous mistakes?
Sure. Yeah, we actually have these wireless summits that we have about once a year, or twice a year or so, where kind of the movers and shakers of each community get together. We've had one up in Seattle. We had one in Portland. So far, they've been somewhat West Coast things right now. We were going to try to have one back in this last June, where we had a free wireless conference. Which was originally scheduled for Las Vegas, but it looks like it's going to be probably more West Coast. It's getting rescheduled for probably end of or first of next year. So we all sort of communicate back and forth, and there's a number of sort of quote-unquote meta mailing lists, too, that we sort of share information about, too. And we all try to, you know, get together. In fact, at the last, we had a meeting about 3 or 4 months ago where we sort of got together and tried to figure out how we were going to deal with the conference as well as share notes on what people are doing. People are constantly stealing my slide presentations as well and showing them at other community networks.
Do you want to show us some of those so we can steal them?
Oh, yeah. Sure.
Send us your slideshow so I can steal it.
You can go ahead and download it. It's all Star Office or whatever. You can use it. You can use the things that usually I try to tell people, and this is one thing that usually gets ignored in sort of like interviews like this, is the regulatory issues that people sort of ignore and people really need to address sometime in their thoughts about deploying is what is appropriate along lines of power, radiation, you know, what's a good engineering practice of like deploying a network and such. I was just reading a mailing list today with the BayWug mailing list where somebody was trying to do a point-to-point link, but they were doing it with two omnidirectional antennas. And this is just a bad idea. I mean, you're just effectively polluting the spectrum in areas that you don't want to cover. So sort of a lot of these sort of thoughts people should think about before they start putting up omnidirectional antennas and start creating their own NAMs or neighborhood area networks.
If you're going point-to-point, you're wasting all that power on splattering the propagation in 360 degrees. That's wrong.
Right. Not only you're wasting the power, but you're spreading it into areas that you don't intend to cover. And so those people who want to use that piece of spectrum in that turf are prevented from doing it.
That's
or
right.
They're going to be caused to have interference or whatever.
And that spectrum is used for not just Wi-Fi.
Right. Actually, there's a paper on my website, which is if you go to lns.com and you click on papers, essays, and rants. And
could you give that URL out a little slower one more time?
Oh, sure. Lns.com.
For late night software.
Late night software. And then if you click on the button that says papers, essays, and rants or something like that, and then there's another button called Demystifying Part 15. There was a paper that came out of a O'Reilly Emerging Technology Conference speech that I did, which talked about all the regulatory issues that you would encounter. But not only that, but it also lists all the other users in the Part 15 bands that you have to you're likely going to run up against. Typically, for instance, ENG vehicles use that. It's channels 8 and 9 for electronic news gathering for video. So you may find that your channel may get wiped out or your path may get wiped out because somebody's trying to shoot a video up to a mountaintop. There is NTIA, which is the federal government, tends to use this band for, or 2.4 and 5.8 for radar. Public safety uses it for video downlinks, and these are people with guns, and they tend to shoot at people who interfere with them. So, there's a lot of amateur radio operators tend to use this also. And you're low man on the totem pole with Part 15, by the way. Part 15.5, which is the rules and regulations for the FCC, says, thou shalt not interfere and thou shalt accept all interference. So you have no recourse with these folks. So not trying to, scare people off, and just sort of making people, hopefully people should be aware of what they're doing when they deploy this stuff.
Well, what's people's options beyond the 802 standard?
You mean in licensed?
Yeah, for a free net, for a community network.
Well, 802.11 works actually reasonably well. Obviously, there's new standards coming out like 802.16, which is the MANS, which is a segment of the 802 group where they're trying to deploy MAN-sized networks and such. But the problem is that 802.11 has some limitations along the lines of the protocol and such, so that you're kind of limited to about 15 kilometers. Also, it tends to not play very well. It's not there's issues like hidden transmitter and various other issues where it tends to step on itself very well, or more so than other technologies out there. It works fine for right now, and due to the fact that it's $50 for a radio card or $100 for an access point. We're building these access points that cost about $500, but that do a lot. It's a good thing to use right now. We're seeing it as we're throwing stuff up on mountaintops and such, and if a new technology comes along, we're going to replace it with that. So at least gets us our foot in the door up on these mountaintops.
Now, in terms of putting the technology on the mountaintops, I presume you're using like point-to-point radios to push the signal up to the mountaintop and then going omnidirectional out?
That's exactly it. There's, for instance, a good path that we have right now is we have an internet service provider as well as an internet archive, which is Brewster Kahle's organization, is donating bandwidth at a location at 6th and Mission in downtown San Francisco. From that location, we have a 24 dBi dish, which is like this 22-foot dish or so, that points up to a mountaintop called Mount San Bruno that's about 6.4 miles away on the path, where we have another 24 dBi dish, another 2-foot dish, pointing back to 6th and Mission. That runs into a little gray box, which we have these little embedded PCs. It's actually a Socris board. I don't know if you've seen these things, but they're little 486s that run at about 133 megahertz or so and take about only 7 watts of power and have compact flash and a couple PCMCA slots on it. And then the first radio obviously talks to the link, and the second radio actually just talks to an 8 dBi Omni up there. So anybody with like a 24 dBi dish can get up to about 8 or 10 miles away and point up to Mount San Bruno and get bandwidth.
Wow.
So that's about a $125 antenna that a user would have to have.
It's actually cheaper. The 24 dBi dishes run around $60 to $70, we're finding them. It does mean that you have to take that and run it in a piece of coax and stick it in a client card.
And a lightning attenuator.
Right.
And so by the time you get the attenuator and the cable, it's $125.
Right. There's actually some nice all-in-one units. Hyperlink Tech makes them, as well as there's a product called Smart Bridge, which basically is kind of like a big patch antenna. It basically looks like a square box that you aim up at the mountaintop. And it has an Ethernet jack on it, so you just run Ethernet all the way down into your house, instead of having to run through this really lossy piece of coax all the way down to your client card.
What about the lightning attenuation?
Well, out here we don't have as much, but it's a good idea to ground the thing as well as you can. Certainly back east you'll have more concern about that.
You guys don't have lightning in San Francisco area?
We don't have that much, actually, yeah.
Wow.
I've been a broadcast engineer around this area, and we rarely have lightning damage in this area. When I lived up and worked up in Seattle, we had much more, but not so much down here.
Wow. Lucky you.
If you put in 24 dBi into Google, you find a whole lot of stuff.
Yeah.
Trying to get it down.
And 802.11 or whatever, yeah.
Yeah.
There's a zillion companies that are making those sort of dishes. Andrew makes kind of the high-end ones, or Conifer, which are probably in the price range you were originally quoting, but there's a company called Pacific Wireless that makes some cheap ones, and there's a bunch of folks that make them. It does cost, if you're looking at sort of the cost on this, there's the transmission line, which is going to be maybe $50 or something like that, but there's also the pigtails, or the adapters that go from the standard end connectors to the proprietary connectors that are usually on your PC and
yeah,
card.
An N female pigtail for $67 at this place.
Yeah, you can get them down to like 25 or so.
Yeah.
Cheaper than that. But it's good to shop around on that kind of stuff, because I've seen prices, again, going usually doubling, if not tripling, for what you can get if you look around.
Yeah, yeah. So, and in Mount San Bruno, for people outside the area, that's where about half or most of the TV and FM stations are. They're
right.
The ones that aren't on Mount Sutra.
Right, and the other half are up on Sutra, right.
Yeah.
We're working, trying to work with Gene Zastro and gang up there on Sutra to put something up there, but likely we're going to get something on Twin Peaks, which is just kind of below Mount Sutra, because it's a really nice location. It's right in dead center in the middle of San Francisco. So it does really well on getting it around San Francisco.
Well, the public station there, KALW, has remarkably good coverage for a fairly low-power signal.
Oh, on Twin Peaks, yeah.
Yeah, they come on Twin Peaks.
So how far can you actually throw that signal with the 24 decibel dish?
Well, we usually put an 8 dBi antenna up, Omni, up on a mountaintop, and you can get about 8 or 10 miles away with a 24 dBi dish if you point it up there. Now, if you're just trying to do a point-to-point link, you know, two 24s aimed at each other, the protocol has a limitation of around 15 kilometers. So you're not going to get the 11 megabit signaling. You'll likely roll back to 2 megabits or so. But you can, you know, there's people that are doing 20, 30-mile links point-to-point very nicely at 2.4.
How much power is going out of the transmitter into that antenna?
Which one are you talking about?
The 8 dBi that you put up on the...
It's 200 milliwatts we're going into there. We're using the little Senio cards or whatever, 200 milliwatts.
Wow.
This is the other part. People, when they deploy this sort of stuff, they have to look at how much power they can do. And depending on if you're doing a point-to-point or point-to-multipoint, the FCC gives you certain allowances for point-to-point, but not for point-to-multipoint. So in the case of point-to-multipoint, you can only do 1 watt transmitter power output, or a TPO, into a 6 dBi antenna. And for every dB of gain that you have in the antenna beyond that, you have to roll back your transmitter 1 dB. So the effective radiated power, which is 1 watt plus 6 dB, is 4 watts. In the case of point-to-point, they're actually a little more lenient. You only have to roll back your transmitter 1 dB for every 3 dB of gain that you have in your antenna.
That's a doubling of power on the antenna.
Pardon?
3 dB is a double power.
Right. So, for instance, if I had a 24 dBi antenna, remember, it's over 6 dB that they start rolling you off on gain. So 24 minus 6 is 18. If I'm 18 dB over the 6, divide by 3, that's 6 dB. So I only have to roll down my transmitters 6 dB below 1 watt, which is a quarter watt.
Are the transmitters rollable?
Typically not, but what you can do is you can figure that the transmission line is going to be attenuating your
power. Oh, I see. So you get your attenuation out of the line.
Yeah.
I see.
I mean, some boxes like the Linksys WAP 11s are. it's a well-known sort of hack on bumping those up to 100 milliwatts by knowing which SNMP OID to put to change.
Ah.
Which is obviously completely not type acceptance if you try to worry about that sort of thing.
Tim, here's an unrelated but still interesting question. If one has Kismet on Linux, I don't know if it's on BSD as well, but if you have Kismet or MacStumbler on a Mac or NetStumbler on a Windows box, and you're looking at the strength figures, which they usually call it strength, I think, which run from 0 to 100 roughly, or to 99.
Right.
What is that? Is that a measure of, somebody told me that signal noise, is that an absolute value of some kind that one, or is that just some interpolation that some hacker came up with?
It's a random value at this point. I mean, depending on the card, I've seen different cards have different things for what their signal strength is.
Mm-hmm.
In the case of, for instance, the Cisco 350s and such, the Cisco cards,
mm-hmm.
you can actually get a DBI or DBM value out of it. You can actually find out how much
that would be nice.
Signal strength there is, because there's a map that you can figure out what their random value is to what DBM is.
Mm-hmm.
But in a lot of them, like the Lucent cards and things like that, they're just sort of this sort of arbitrary range that they work with.
Mm-hmm.
But
so it's really not a meaningful number.
It's meaningful in respect of if you want to like peek up on something, but it's if you're trying to actually get a figure on what your signal strength is
mm-hmm.
at a particular card, it's not going to be meaningful.
So it's roughly helpful if you want you know well I'm getting closer or farther away in a
right.
hot cold sense, but beyond that it's not. Yeah.
Or if you're trying to swing your antenna around it, make sure that you're pointing up to the mountaintop or something.
Mm-hmm.
It's fine for that. One other thing, I don't know. I noticed that I'm 10 minutes over here.
This isn't like real radio. It's okay.
Hey,
one thing that the people
I'm
also
here. It's real.
Okay, I'll stop real quick. One thing that I also try to mention to folks is that there's this concept of type acceptance, and the FCC, when they had licensed transmitters, in other words, you went out and got you coordinated your frequency and you engineered your path and the whole thing. You went out and got a license, and when you did something wrong, they would take your license back and say, bad boy. Well, in the case of Part 15 devices, there's nobody for them to go after because nobody licenses these rigs. It's called unlicensed. So they have to actually go after the manufacturers to say, okay, you have to make sure that any idiot can buy these things and plug them in and it's not going to interfere with NTIA and the police department and everything else. Well, that process is called type acceptance, and they make sure that the antenna, the transmission line, the transmitter is all sort of bolted together, and it goes into a lab, and the lab says, yep, this passes all the RF requirements that the FCC has for Part 15. And then they can start selling this stuff, and they can start, marketing it. Well, if somebody starts taking antenna A from manufacturer A and plugging it into a transmitter from manufacturer B, client card or whatever, they've broken the type acceptance. So if you're planning on deploying a network that's mixing and matching manufacturers, you may find that the FCC, depending on if you are starting to interfere with anybody, the little man will come up and start writing little tickets to you and maybe even confiscate the gear. So it's another consideration when you think about deploying this kind of stuff.
Yeah, they usually give you warnings, though, first.
Yeah, unless you tend to be too much of a dweeb or something like that, then they get nasty. It's the same sort of thing with you were doing pirate radio.
Okay.
Cool.
Anyway, I know
that really makes sense.
Pardon?
That makes sense.
Yeah.
Okay. Got a couple more quick questions.
Sure.
Can people go to your website and get information on the steps that you guys took to create your community freenet?
Yeah. Actually, if you go to the BARN site, the BARN site, that's www.barwn.org. There's a white paper that discusses the sort of philosophy and what we're trying to do that's up there. And there's also a white paper that talks about the routers that we're building and putting up on the mountaintops as well.
Could we have that URL again?
www.barwn.org.
Yeah, right.
Cool.
So, yeah, that's our big thing. And again, this harkens back to the old TLG days and everybody else, the sort of the hacker ethic is that you publish the stuff that you do.
Yep.
And that's exactly what we're trying to do. Anything that, any sort of geek hack or anything that's kind of neat or any sort of stuff like the papers that I'm publishing on regulatory is all free. It's all being put under Creative Commons licenses and such so that people can use it at least up to some extent.
Yep. Well, I want to thank you for coming on the show. We are well beyond the time, but you've been really a very, very interesting guest. In fact, we'd really like to have you come back. I'm going to get a hold of you offline after the show.
Sure.
And discuss about you coming on in the future, because there's actually two or three other people that are in the process of doing community networks right now, and after they've had a chance to work on them for another month or so, I thought it was going to be really cool to get everybody together on a panel and put heads together on developing some information on what worked and what didn't work and things like that to help other people to push this as an alternative business model to bandwidth. And in addition, when I do contact you, if I don't give it to you, remind me. I have a DSL provider that has no bandwidth caps and is reasonably priced.
Excellent.
And encourages Wi-Fi.
Mine does. Mine does too. I've got a great ISP.
Is this one? Is that of Seattle?
No.
Oh,
I'll give it to you.
That's interesting. I mean, Cox out here doesn't discourage it. I'm told Verizon in New York actually will sell you a Wi-Fi base station.
Cool.
So,
I have an internet provider here in Ontario, and I can't even mention their name because I like to promote it. These guys are really good. They're very Linux friendly, and they don't make any restrictions on what I do with my bandwidth. And, you know, and I can put up a wireless if I just want. And I intend to do that in the next few weeks.
Great. EFF has a web page of ISP-friendly Wi-Fi spots. Wireless-friendly ISPs.
Yeah. Well, my internet service provider is keyway.net, and that's K-E-Y-W-A-Y.
Great.
No, they're just really, really tremendous folks over there, and I got to give them a plug.
Great. Well, good talking to you folks.
Okay. Thanks again for coming on, and I look forward to having you on the show. Kevin, why don't you put in an advertisement or a musical interlude, and we'll come back on the third segment of tonight's edition of The Winner Show with Chris Perillo, if he's still out there in the chat room. I haven't looked in a few minutes. Hope he's still there. Chris, it's time to call in if you haven't called in yet. We'll be back in about 3 or 4 minutes. This is the Tuesday night edition of The Linux Show for July the 1st, 2003. We will be right back. Hang in there, everyone.
While carrying on a game of golf, I may make a play for the caddy. But when I do, I don't follow through because my heart belongs to daddy. If I invite a guy to dine out to find Finn and Hattie, I just adore, he's asking for more, but my heart belongs to daddy. My heart belongs to daddy. Simply could it be bad? And my heart belongs to daddy. Bad, 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 bad. Want to warn you, daddy, so I think you're perfectly sweet. My heart belongs to daddy, cause my daddy, he treats us so well.
And we're back.
It's the Linux Show for Tuesday, July the 1st, 2003. We're back with segment number 3 of our extended show. It's already 20 after 9. Here we're having a 2-hour-long show, and we're already late. Man, I too much to talk about, I guess. But thanks, everybody, for hanging in there tonight and sticking with us for this extra amount of time. Thanks for coming back, I should say, after last week's train wreck. Happening a little too often these days. I don't want to sound paranoid or like we're accusing somebody out there of
sabotaging us. I don't think that's the case, but hopefully it'll happen a little less often in the future. Let's go ahead and jump right into segment number three. An old friend of mine and Doc's and boy, a lot of other people in the geek universe is Chris Perillo. This is Chris's technically second time on the show because he was here last week. But we're really excited to have Chris here, at least in terms of my exposure with Chris. I can't even remember when I first came in contact with you, Chris. It had something to do probably with an email list, though, I would venture a guess. It may have even been the book you wrote about email lists, for all I know. I just can't remember, but it's been a long time. But in my opinion, and heck, I'm not the only one out there, Chris is, without question, one of the mavens of opt-in list use on the Internet. He's one of the people who have, well, not only written a book about it, but has found a successful business formula that does not include spam and that people love and has done well. So welcome to the show tonight, Chris.
Thanks. No, I appreciate it. I was just curious, did you guys want to go out and get some coffee? Sounds like you need to wake up.
Yeah. Actually, I've been sitting here drinking Guinness for the last couple hours.
Guinness? Oh, that would explain it.
That's why I'm such a happy guy.
Yeah,
or espresso in there won't look any different.
Yeah. No, actually, I was upset last week, obviously, for not being able to participate in a show that didn't happen. But I've been waiting to kind of reinstall Mandrake Linux onto my laptop because I was going to do it on the show. So I've had to wait for a week to do this, because I'm going to do it right now. On a laptop that is a Dell laptop running, it used to run Windows, and I tested the latest Windows OS on it, and, well, now I'm going to go back to Mandrake.
Yay!
So you tried installing the latest Windows, it's with Windows with an L?
Windows with an L, yes. And, you know, I have high hopes for the Windows OS in a commercial sense, like moms and pops. But from my point of view, it is not for the advanced user at all.
Pretty tamed.
It's not just that. It's just that the UI really sucks. And I've had this complaint for desktop environments for years. It's one of the reasons why when Apple released OS X, I went out and I got an iMac. I like it. I love it. I love the environment. I love the user interface. So I run Linux at home. I run Mac OS X. I run Windows. Several virtual machines. Several hardware. So it doesn't matter. I mean, from my point of view, I don't care what operating system. Pardon me. Woo! Cashew went down the wrong pipe. It doesn't matter to me what operating system it is, as long as it's got software that can support it, and as long as it looks good and doesn't really require that much configuration to really be customized to your liking.
Well, let's talk about that for a second, because that's something I've always found interesting about you, Chris, is that you seem obsessed, and this isn't a bad thing, okay, but you seem obsessed with whether or not a GUI looks good or not.
Well, because that's such a big part of the user experience. It's not so much the message as it is who's presenting the message. It's what you see that's going to give you the feeling of, wow, this looks good, this looks polished. Now, whether or not it's actually polished underneath is a different story. But if I can't stand to look at something, I'm not going to want to use it. This was my exact argument against Lotus Notes. People would argue with me saying, oh, yes, but it's so powerful and this, that. I don't care. You know, a baboon's butt could be powerful, but I don't want to stare at it for, you know, half of my afternoon. I want to stare at something that looks good. I want to use something that's usable. And this is the exact reason why I've come back on multiple platforms and blasted many programmers for the lack of a smart and customizable UI.
So, based upon that logic, shouldn't all of our GUIs have tits?
Have what?
Tits.
Well, I guess it just depends on what kind of person you are. it's something that, you know, coming from my point of view, if I'm the person who's translating something, which we may understand technically, to someone who may not understand anything, then I have to make sure and be sure that the experience they have is going to be good. It's been difficult. I mean, you just got done speaking about talking about wireless networks. It's been difficult at times to tell people, hey, embrace this technology, because it wasn't easy. You know, there was a learning curve. But technology is finally getting to the point where it is easy to use, where it is literally plug and play. Yeah, you're going to have issues, but that goes without saying. The less issues someone is going to have with something, the easier it is going to be adopted by other people. Case in point, file sharing. Obviously just a huge, huge deal. But it's relatively easy to do. You click a button, all of a sudden you're sharing files, you've got access to, well, anybody else who's connected, you've got access to their hard drive, or at least segmented portions of it. It was easy, and it spread like wildfire because the benefits of using a file sharing client were just astounding. Well, wireless internet access for most people is not that big a deal, but now that it's getting easier to create not only just a wireless network, but, you know, a home network, and people have more than one machine, maybe just, you know, a regular desktop machine, but they've also got their laptop from work, they're starting to see the benefits of having a wireless network. And so even if there is a slight learning curve, they're willing to take that chance. They're willing to gamble on that because the benefits on the back end are great. Now, from my point of view, the user interface is what they're going to be interacting with. The smarter it is, the easier my job is. Because if I don't have to explain to someone how to edit a configuration file or how to dive into an options panel like three tabs down, hey, life is better. So from my point of view, things have to be intuitive in order to be adopted. And this is all across the board. I think Linux stands a decent chance of being adopted as a desktop platform, not as much as it does as a server platform. But OS X, I think, is Linux's biggest competitor at this point.
On the desktop. Well, from what everything I've seen it a couple of times. I've never used it. I don't have an Apple. But from everything I've seen on OS X is pretty nice.
It's very elegant.
Well, it's nice. It's elegant. It's not at the point yet where I think it's fast. I mean, as responsive as I'm used to. Running in Windows is my primary desktop platform, but it does show promise. It's very, very. I mean, the thing's, you know, built on top of a very powerful, I guess, base. You know, without getting too technical.
I'll tell you, it's fast enough. I'm right now. I'm using a 17-inch PowerBook G4 in front of me here, and there's not much slow to talk about here.
You really suck, Doc, for having a 17-inch PowerBook.
Well, it's a loaner. I can't keep it, so.
Oh, well, then you're forgiven.
Yeah.
It's a nice-looking machine.
It does a job. I mean, it is... I have to say, I have such a sort of a love-hate thing going there because, like, with the new video iChat, which I've just been trying out with people, is stunning.
You got it?
Absolutely stunning.
So do I. I've got the iSight plugged in. I'm on.
Oh, you're on?
Yeah.
This is the Linux show. Let's not go there. We can do it later.
I guess.
Here you go.
Yeah, I posted it actually to my blog, my .Mac handle, and helped about 13 different people play with their little iChat client, including Mac Slash, which is kind of, I guess you could consider a slash dot for the Mac.
But the thing is, it doesn't interoperate yet, you know, which is too bad.
I think that's becoming an increasingly frustrating thing with the interoperability of IM.
And it is inexcusable that the guys that are involved in IM, and I know that from my Jabber friends that Apple is somewhere in there, they're using the Jabber protocol. You know, why not go the extra mile and just do something that's open? You know, finally, somebody endorse Jabber or Simple or something, and let's get an open IM protocol going out there, you know, and it still ain't happening. I was kind of hoping that Apple would make the move on this one, but they haven't done it yet. But they have a history of, like, you know, doing something that starts out as a silo and then moves out, like they did with iPod. The first one only, you know, you could only, it would only interoperate with Macs, and then eventually they made it interoperable. So, who knows? But I'm still waiting.
Yeah, and you will wait for a while yet.
Yeah, yeah.
Not to digress too much on this interesting discussion on desktop, but I do want to, while we got you on the show tonight, I do want to talk about lists for just a couple of minutes, because the people who listen to this show are pretty hardcore users, and they would actually enjoy a conversation about listserv where most people, you know, may not, and so I think the topic is appropriate.
You may be in trouble then. I think email publishing is dead.
You really do think?
I believe it in my heart of hearts.
But
that publishing is dead?
Email marketing and email publishing is dead.
Even in opt-in lists?
Even in opt-in lists, even in double opt-in lists, dead.
So
you're the guy who's doing 8.5 million exposure.
I know, it's ironic. It's dead. Dead.
So it's a list of the living dead? That's what you're doing?
Kinda, yeah. It's kind of a placeholder at this point. And speaking to this, you know, I guess I've been involved with the email publishing industry for years, and I say publishing over marketing just because what I do is send out content to people who want to receive it, you know, and I equate publishing to sitting down in front of the television. Do you watch the programming or do you watch the commercials? Well, unless it's the Super Bowl, chances are you're watching the programming, and that's what I believe email publishing is. It's getting to the point now where it's impossible to deliver an email message to someone, even if they have opted in, because you're having to deal with headaches in between, whether it's their ISP who has set up some type of, well, for the lack of a better term, you know, anti-spam software, or it's the actual user who is inadvertently cutting off the certain legitimate email that they had requested because of an anti-spam filter. Or it's all of these things combined with not only the stuff that I'm doing, but the stuff that everybody else is doing. So some people will throw the baby out with the bathwater. We've been reported so many times to organizations saying that we're spam, even though we're not. We're a confirmed opt-in list. You cannot be added to our distributions unless you say, yes, I want to be added. It's impossible. It's physically impossible. Yet we still fall into that category. So when I explain to people what I do for a living, and they say, oh, you're a spammer. Why do I have to defend my business practice? Why do I have to defend that when I know I'm fully legitimate? I'm getting blamed as being guilty without even having a chance to say, hey, I'm innocent. Email publishing and email marketing is dead. No longer a viable business.
You mean it's
medium.
Been so polluted by the spammers that anything that's legitimate is so totally tarred by it that
it's gone. It's gone.
Don't you think the sentiment in Washington, D.C. right now is to finally...
Forget it. I don't care if any laws are passed. Then you're playing with the mentality of people. You can't change pop culture. You can't change the way people think. It just happens over time. And people are so used to I guess, not necessarily receiving information by email, but receiving the wrong information by email. When the signal-to-noise ratio is completely out of proportion, you've lost. There's no way you can deliver a message. I mean, even with the strongest branding, when you go to a website and you see information that you want to read and that you know you want, can you trust that user? Or that particular sender? Can you trust them? Can you trust your email address with a company who you either know or you don't know? It's impossible. When was the last time you didn't think twice when you hit a form to fill out with your email address? And some people will use, you know, services like the temporary email services, which is fine if you want to go through that hassle, but mom and pop America, they don't want to mess with that. They don't want that hassle. Then, let's take it a step further. You've got challenge response systems, which are going to become the norm. I fully believe that. Challenge response systems being, if I were to send an email to Doc, I would immediately, if I had not been prior, if there hadn't been a prior approval process, I would be immediately sent back something saying, hey, you sent an email message to so-and-so, enter in this code or do this, that, or the other thing, jump through these flaming hoops before the email message is actually going to be delivered. This is going to make it even more difficult for legitimate email publishers and, to a certain degree, email marketers to get their message across.
And email users.
Email. It's destroyed. It's gone. I'm not saying that email's going to go away. Don't get me wrong.
Don't you think that if... I mean, the biggest mistake that the government ever made with email was taking it out of the hands of ISPs. ISPs had abuse policies. They had systems in place. It worked for years. If we went back to that system, you don't think it would...
No. I honestly don't think any amount of regulation is going to stop this. I don't. And I know some people are going to argue to their grave, but I'm telling you, people have stopped sharing their information because they don't know who's going to get it. They don't want to share that anymore. They don't trust anybody anymore. But here's the thing. There's already a replacement. There's a legitimate replacement for email marketing, and it's happening right now.
And that is?
RSS.
Oh, syndication.
RSS.
No,
in spite of the fact that there's huge disagreement.
It doesn't matter. Ignore the disagreement. It's a stupid thing. What matters is being able to get your information across in an easy format. That's why blogging took off. And some people, blogging, it's nothing more than web pages. Blah. That's not true. It's an easy way to publish your personal thoughts and to be part of a global conversation. The key thing is that it's easy to do. RSS is easy to implement. When the desktop aggregators, which are getting to the point where they can be adopted on a mass scale, when they keep developing and publishers continue to publish in a format which users wish to receive, RSS will take off. I guarantee it.
Yeah,
RSS is the future of electronic publishing.
I completely agree that it's definitely going to take off. I don't know if it's going to turn out to be the future of electronic publishing.
It is.
But I believe it's going to take off enough that I have been spending an inordinate amount of time the last 6 months working on RSS project. So.
Let me tell you why it will take off, though. You have to understand the reason email publishing works is because it's instant, it's targeted, it's information that is presented in a format which people wish to digest. I started email publishing and walking down this road years ago when I thought to myself, well, see here, how many bookmarks or favorites do I have? You know, dozens, you know, maybe even hundreds at that point. And how many of those did I visit on a regular basis? Maybe one, two, three. Well, I started thinking, well, maybe if I'm this way, other people are too. Instead of me having to go to the information should come to me. And that's why I walked down the road of email publishing. Well, now that's no longer a viable commercial avenue. It's not. The same things can be accomplished with RSS or Echo, or I don't care what the hell you want to call it.
Except Echo doesn't exist, RSS does.
Yeah, RSS solves the problem, and you can authenticate, because it just uses, like, a login over HTTP. You can authenticate, meaning you could, like, have a username and a password assigned to a specific URL, or put it in the URL, or, you know, have it munged to the point where you can't tell what it is, and assign it to an account. Or, in order to subscribe to an RSS feed, I don't have to do anything except say, I want you, my desktop aggregator of choice, to go out and get this feed every X hours. I don't have to give up my email address. The web server is not going to know me any more than it's going to know me if I visit its web page. But the information is going to come to me, and that information it can be archived 7 ways from Sunday. Again, depending on the aggregator of choice.
And
there are plenty of aggregators.
At this point, that one of our pals here, Dave Siffrey, is with Technorati, advanced blogging enormously by taking RSS and publishing something on demand that tells you who exactly has linked to what in almost in real time, so that it is, you don't have to look at referrer logs and kind of find your way back. You can actually go and see. Let's see. You know, 5 minutes ago, so and so said this about so and so. So and so linked this to this. It's an incredible thing.
And Daypop makes it easy too. Feedster does as well. It's instant marketing communications. It's funny, but when someone posts about me or mentions my name and I'm the first to comment or I respond to it, they're shocked. They don't know how it happened. Well, I found out minutes after they did this, thanks to services like Technorati or Daypop or Feedster. RSS is a very, very, very powerful thing, and it's going to replace email as a publishing platform.
Yeah, the only downside is that as a person working on an RSS development right now, I'm already seeing a lot of roadblocks being put in the way by the content providers who are blocking us from aggregating their content.
Then don't deal with them. I subscribe to over 300 feeds.
Yeah, it's tough when it's Slashdot, though, you know?
Well, okay, well, if Slashdot's not allowing you to scrape, that's a problem. If you're pinging it too often, it's going to tell you, hey, slow down, your IP is banned.
No, they've changed the threshold tolerance to be very narrow.
You know, and to a certain degree, it's kind of funny. I responded to a press release last night that was talking about Andy Borland's new effort, which I'm trying to think of the website offhand. It's like a marketing type of website. And it was a press release, and I responded, and I said, I knew this, like, last week. Thanks to RSS, I knew 5 minutes after it happened. Where have you been? It's instant communication that's being spread out. You bring up Slashdot, and I think it's an important point to bring up, because for years, you know, Slashdot's a great website. They've, you know, got great pointers. Sometimes I argue the validity of the discussion that follows, but I think Slashdot has lost its power because of the decentralization of information, because of blogging, because of RSS. Slashdot's effects are going to be lessened and lessened because of RSS, because it's that easy.
Yeah, perhaps.
I'm telling you, watch it happen. That's the way it happens. There comes a time when, as an email publisher, you have to look at, is this working? Is this still working? You know, as a marketer, you look at the way certain things are done and how they could be done better. And when we started looking at our logs, we realized, oh, God, we're no longer gaining subscribers. Why is this? We're losing subscribers, even though people are subscribing at a record rate. It's because things are getting blocked. Or because, you know, they're just not confirming that it's their address. Or that, you know, their ISP drops. We're going to lose, I'm sure, thousands of subscribers tonight when AT&T BI switches over to Comcast.net. It's impossible to keep up with email. You don't have those problems with RSS. Now, that said, the big question is, where is there a desktop aggregator that works, and that works well? For OS X, there's NetNewsWire, which is arguably, you know, the world's most elegant RSS client. For Windows, you've got a mix of things. Now, everybody and their grandmother seems to want to code an aggregator, but I think the leaders in the field are going to be FeedDemon, coded by Nick Bradbury, who wrote HomeSite, which was is almost still one of the most popular Windows HTML editors. He also wrote TopStyle, a CSS editor. He's working on FeedDemon for Windows, and it just blows the rest away. You also have NewsGator, which is a news aggregator that integrates within Outlook. Kind of like you have Evolution that has a built-in aggregator. You know what I'm talking about, right?
Yeah.
Okay. When people start realizing that they don't have to give up their personal information to get information and have it come to them in a convenient format, the way they want it, and when they realize that if they don't want it anymore, they can simply delete a feed, people will understand. When I started getting email messages from clueless PR people, and I say this in the nicest way, but people who normally wouldn't know a palm from a pocket PC are saying, wow, you were talking about RSS. I didn't understand it until I saw this. Now I get it. They get it. And content providers will either have to adapt or they will die. It's a guarantee.
Yeah,
watch it happen.
That I agree. It'll be slow.
And I'm saying this because this is what I've been doing. You know, as you had said, Jeff, you know, I wrote the book on email publishing. I know that game. I also know where it's headed. It's gone. It's dead. It's going to be a matter of time. I'm telling you, if anybody out there says that their email list is growing, they're lying. I guarantee it, they're lying. It's impossible. Either they're renting the lists, they're buying email addresses, or they've got one hell of a marketing department. Because the rate at which email addresses are dropping is just astronomical. The only way only we were able to turn our email numbers around were by instituting a rather, I don't think it was that controversial personally, but a rather controversial service called Habeas. Now, Habeas is a service, habeas.com, H-A-B-E-A-S. You may remember the Latin term habeas corpus, or proof of the body, I believe is what that stands for in Latin. Habeas.com, as long as you pay a fee if you're a legitimate publisher, you can insert these headers, email headers, into your headers of an email message of a trademarked haiku. And Habeas works on my behalf, as well as other legitimate publishers' behalf, to talk to companies and people who have anti-spam products. So we're automatically whitelisted on certain products because we carry the Habeas headers, because we have been certified legitimate. Some people have gone to the point saying that these guys are going to take away free email. Yeah, right. And I'm going to sign Bill 802P or whatever the hell it is. It's a misnomer. Habeas has been doing the best job for legitimate email publishers, but it's still not enough. It's not enough. It's no longer a legitimate business. You know, for a couple of weeks ago, there was a big thing with Greg Raniker, who codes NewsGator, instituting advertising in InfoWorld's RSS feeds. Well, I told Greg, and, you know, I don't want to steal his thunder because he's got a great product. In fact, that's the product of my choosing. I use it. I told him, I said, well, LockerGnome, my website and services have had ads in RSS feeds. This is not new. RSS is just a different way of not only publishing information, but you're receiving information. And then depending, of course, on the client, parsing the information.
Chris, I got to interrupt you for a minute because there's something funny going on in the IRC.
Oh, I'm sure.
You're such an enthusiastic person.
Well, I told you guys, you need to wake up.
Chris, you're precious. You come back anytime.
Jeez. Okay, what's going on?
There's actually people in the IRC who think you're mad at me.
I'm not mad at you.
Isn't that funny?
I'm just passionate.
This is just the way Chris is, everybody.
Okay, you got to understand my background. Jeff, you just touched upon it. I mean, I recently came out to the Bay Area a couple years ago to host a show on Tech TV, which I'm no longer on, daily, a live television show, helping new computer users with, you know, computer problems, or telling people, you know, what they should be getting. I'm no longer there. But that came about only because of my experience, you know, writing a book, running LockerGnome, doing just wacky things. Now I'm at the point where I'm focused more on what I'm going to be doing within my industry, you know, just technology in general. I got into the whole blogging thing. I mean, because I've been blogging for years. If you boil it down to it, my personality has been in my newsletters from LockerGnome from day one. And LockerGnome, of course, has expanded from just a Windows newsletter to now we have a Linux newsletter, now currently being written by Dion LeBlanc, who I believe wrote Linux for Dummies, as well as a handful of other Linux-related titles. So we're constantly publishing technology information, and so I've been doing this, like I said, for about 7 years, but I'm always doing wacky side projects like rentmychest.com, where you can go over there and rent my chest for $20. You got to PayPal it to me. And I'll write whatever you want on my chest. And some people just go, what, Chris, you're crazy. Well, you're right, but I made $2,000 with that damn thing. So as crazy as it may be, it worked. And it actually serves as a model for future businesses that I'm working on. So, I mean, take this to the level where I'm just an enthusiast. And if I get behind something, I'm going to be excited about it. And that excitement sometimes translates, and it may sound like I'm mad at somebody. I'm not. I'm just very excitable. And it doesn't take much, because I've only had 3 cups of coffee today. So, one of the reasons why you wanted me to come on the show, too, was to talk about our upcoming conference.
Yes, the
GnomeDex, which Doc was at last year.
GnomeDex Experience.
It was.
GnomeDex is a great conference.
And it really...
It's a people's conference.
Exactly. And that's what I set up the conference to be. You know, I've been to tons of conferences and tons of places where you couldn't connect with the other people. And even if you could, you didn't like connecting with them. Or realizing that a lot of the reason why people like going to things like Comdex was because of the parties. And I said, well, why not make the whole conference a party? Why not make the whole thing fun? Why not give free Wi-Fi to everybody? Okay, let's do it. So we did, and we're hitting our third year. And I take, you know, the approach, I mean, we've got Microsoft on as a title sponsor, but we've also got Google on as a title sponsor. You know, we've got people speaking, I mean, Doc was a tough act to follow, believe me, but John C. Dvorak, Jim Louderback, Commander Taco, of course, from Slashdot, Google's going to be presenting something, one of their developers are.
Hey, Chris, a quick question. Are you going to get John to admit he was wrong about predicting that Apple was going to go with Intel instead of PowerPC?
You know, John is a funny character. He really is, by the way. He's like that in real life. And I'm sure, Doc, you've met him.
Yeah, I know, John. I'm just putting it out there.
Somebody asked
me to ask that, actually. So
I think I may be able to get his goat. I may be able to. I'm working on a book with him. That's going to be published in October, and he had mentioned this on boingboing.net a couple weeks ago when he was a guest blogger. By the way, I'm the source of his whole tirade against blogging. He hasn't come out and said that. I think he was protecting my identity. But when we were both still at Tech TV, I was just getting into movable type and showing him, hey, check this out. This is great. This is so cool. He's like, what is that? Blogs are no good unless you have pictures of cats and blah, blah, blah. No one cares.
Yeah, he ranted against Clue Train, too. He forgot I was actually on his show. You know, I signed a book for him.
Oh, that's awesome. You know, I have your signature. I have David's and Chris's.
It's hard to get Rick.
Oh, yeah. Impossible.
Yeah.
Impossible. But, no, I'm having fun with this stuff. And if anybody in the chat room thinks that I'm mad at anybody, I'm not. I'm not.
You know, Chris, you're entering into a conversation with Chris, and you're tempted just to say with tongue-in-cheek, there you go, mincing words again, Chris.
Well, you know, I mean, that's one of the reasons why I enjoy this industry, because there's always something new happening. There's always something to share with other people. I mean, I've now started to kind of almost inspire other people to go out and get cell phones with cameras in them, because I started photo blogging with my Nokia 3650. I bought it instantaneously. I was publishing pictures to the web. I mean, just boom, done. I mean, it was that. I show people. I'm like, this is how easy it is. Look, click, click, click. Can you do that? You're done. I just uploaded a picture to the web. It's phenomenal. And now that I'm doing it, other people are following suit. Because until now, it's like, well, what's the reason of having a picture or a camera on your phone? Well, there's a guy out there, at least on TextAmerica.com, TextAmerica.com, there's a link to it over at my blog, Chris.Perillo.com, or Google for Chris, and I think I'm like the number one Chris on Google at this point. I may be number two, though. But there's a guy out there who is a gynecologist who is
number
photo
one.
Blogging. What's that?
You're number one.
Am I number one? Okay, great. Out of how many million? I think it was like 27, maybe 19?
19 million.
19 million. Number one.
The number two, Doc, but I fell to number three.
Oh, dang it.
Yeah.
Well, you know, it's been an interesting experiment for me in you know, playing with things like blogging and understanding that it's more than just a cult of personality. It's really a dynamic conversation that anybody can tap into and from that can take something away and add something to. I think the only reason why RSS has been taking off as a viable medium is because of blogging, because it's automatically generated through the templates. And people go, what is this? What do I do with this? And they learn. And so the quicker that blogs get adopted, the quicker that RSS will get adopted. It'll just be created. It's a byproduct. And from this, of course, you know, Google gives you love because other people give you love. I mean, I'm saying, you know, sharing links or whatnot. But, you know, I've taken all this stuff, and after having shared this information for free with LockerGnome, I turned around and created, I'm basically now a consultant. I'm consulting with companies on repurposing their content because I've been doing it. You know, I know how to. I look at something and go, "Well, gee, how can I take this same stuff and actually, you know, make it worth something?" You know, last year, in March 2002, decided to just repurpose some of the content that was sitting in our archives into PDF files. And you say, well, you know, we're going to sell these PDF files for, you know, $5 a pop. It's just, you know, we're just organizing the information for you. We're just reorganizing it, making it easy and digestible. Like, last year, that effort alone pulled in about $50,000 off of content that may have already been sitting on our website for free. So I looked at that type of model and said, well, gee, you know, if I can repurpose this, what else can I repurpose? And so other efforts have been made in showing not only people how to do what I've been doing, but building Locker Gnome in much the same fashion and moving it towards, I guess, more content-based services. Last week, we issued about 160 Amazon.com feeds, and just last night, we added the ability for you to customize your own feed. And when I say feed, I'm talking about an RSS feed. So if you wanted to be up to date on the latest sci-fi books from Amazon, you could literally go to our website and have that feed custom created for you. Of course, it's got our affiliate program in there, and we would sell the code to anybody who would want to buy it. But that is the future of where we're headed. You know, looking at the information that's already out there, how can we create a value add? Creating services like I called it my brain trust for the lack of a better word over at Perillo.com. Some people just go insane. People pay me $97 a month to hear my advice and other people's advice. I say, well, hell, how much do you pay a consultant per hour? You know, if it's not over $100, chances are you don't have a very good consultant. So $97 a month to get access to my brain as well as my brain trust ain't so bad an idea. So it's looking at, you know, the stuff that I'm doing is seeing how it could work in either a commercially viable format, because, you know, I've got to put a roof over my head and I've got, you know, mouths to feed too. But doing it in such a way where I'm not expending so much energy or wasting time.
I'd like to give it a little bit of a 90-degree turn. I'd like to ask you a more directed question. As someone who has been a strong advocate of Microsoft over the years, do you have a comment about Bill Gates' appearance at the White House this past weekend and his concern over internet privacy and computer privacy when you look at all of the spyware that Bill Gates has directed Microsoft include in .NET technology as well as XP?
Well, first of all, clarify my position on Microsoft. I treat them as I treat any other technology company. I don't love everything they do, and I don't hate everything they do. And I say that because some people think that, you know, I support Microsoft no matter what.
I'd never say that.
No, I know. But what I'm saying is that I have been very critical of Microsoft, while, on the other hand, I have been very supportive of Microsoft, just depending on the efforts. I mean, like Windows Millennium Edition, a colossal mistake. Their Movie Maker product, a colossal mistake. And I've said these things publicly, but, you know, on the other hand, you know, they've made some products that I think work very well. So I wanted to clarify that position, and I hopefully, you know, by saying that I'm also running OS 10 and installing Mandrake 9.1, working in Windows, hopefully that, you know, puts me in a position where I do have some amount of validity in saying this. Microsoft, I think, is at a very interesting stage in the game. At one point, I would consider Windows the only viable choice for people because of the software that was available. This has changed. Software is a commodity. In fact, when I got into OS X, I started to realize, wow, there's some good products out there. Why can't I get them for this other operating system? Software is available. It's the question of how are people going to adopt to the software that's created. What is the next killer app? what's that going to be? And from Microsoft's point of view, they're trying to, you know, assemble their .NET and get it everywhere. And they're opening it up. I mean, it's not just a Windows thing. It's for anything. I could point you to a couple of resources, but I don't know if I'd be as good at it as people who are involved in that community. I think it's not... I don't think we're at the point where we have to necessarily worry. I think there's a lot of fear, uncertainty, and doubt in privacy. I think privacy is an illusion. Not to say that you shouldn't worry about it. You should. But I think that a lot of people worry about things that I don't think need to be worrying about. The cookies, for one. I've never been harmed by a cookie. Some people swear against them. Fine. That's your life. That's your computer. It's up to you. But I don't think the average user is going to be harmed by it.
Yeah, but
I'm also of the mindset where I am willing, or I would be willing. I don't have a TiVo, but if TiVo wants to track my habits, if TiVo wants to focus advertising, if I see another tampon commercial as long as I live, hello, that's not me. That's not my demographic. If all I get served are ads for computer stuff and technology, is that a problem? Who has a problem with that? I have no problem with that whatsoever. TiVo is playing kind of the same kind of game where these companies, they need to know more about the people who are using their products. Now, whether that happens to be tying in their preferences, and of course they've got to be completely upfront about, you know, what they're doing with the information. And some people say, well, you can't trust Microsoft. Well, I can trust Microsoft as much as I can trust every other company on this planet. Seriously.
Very little.
Yeah, well, exactly. I have very little trust for companies, any company. I only place my trust specifically in people who I would know. And even sometimes then, that trust is invalidated through experiences. So it's having the information available so that people who do care and do understand and that can translate that and can eliminate the fear, uncertainty, and doubt, so that they can do that effectively. I just don't think it's going to be as bad or as evil as people might say it will be. I really don't. I'm willing to give up a few megabytes on my hard drive for cookies, because I know when I go back to a website, I don't have to log in, or I don't have to tell it that I'm a geek. It just knows. I have no problem with that, and I think anybody who does is deluding themselves. I think if anybody believes in privacy, and I'm not saying it's not an important thing, but what I'm saying is that the health insurance industry breaks far more privacy rules than the Internet does. Privacy is an illusion. And I'm not saying that as someone who says, well, you shouldn't care, because you should care. But I think by believing that you can be 100% protected all the time, your name is Ted Kaczynski, and you live in a shack in the middle of Montana, because that's the only way it's going to happen.
Okay, I can buy your argument, but there's a difference between tracking a person's use on the Internet to see whether they go to MSNBC or CNN. Okay, that's one thing. Okay, but there's another thing altogether when you've got the technology being put into .NET and XP that will allow software to independently go out and determine what software is running on a corporate LAN.
Okay.
That is an absolute intrusion upon the privacy of that company.
Understand this. You and I, we can apply software updates. We can apply patches. We can do this. We can configure machines. Joe and Judy user out there cannot.
I don't buy that as an argument, as a legitimate argument.
Okay, okay.
If they sold me an operating system, it should have worked to begin with.
Then don't buy that operating system.
Okay,
if your total cost of ownership...
I don't have a choice.
But wait, time out. If you don't have a choice, then why is that? Is it because of the company?
It's because Microsoft invalidates my license.
Well, if you break their end user license agreement, is that what are you trying to circumvent something?
No. Okay. Let's give an exact case in point. Okay, so that we're not dancing around the fringes. An exact case in point.
I've got a company. I've got 10,000 users, of which 5,000 of my 10,000 users are using Windows 98 Second Edition, and I'm having no problem. I'm running fine. And I'm running Office 97. And yet, Joe Salesman from Microsoft comes knocking on my door and says, "We've just invalidated your license." No Microsoft solution provider on the planet will support you any longer, at least if they're part of Microsoft's channel. No, at least one will support you until you upgrade. That's forcing people to buy something that they don't need.
They don't need?
Yeah, they don't.
Okay, I was just saying, wait, come on. Do you know the difference between Windows 98 and, let's say, something like Windows 2000?
Oh, yeah, you bet I do. I've been in this business
a while. Well, I'm saying that I understand. I'm not questioning your experience. What I'm saying is that there is a need for users to upgrade from Windows 98 to Windows 2000 for stability reasons alone.
Okay, well, I could argue that with you till I'm blue in the face.
That's fine.
Okay, bottom line, the reality of it is the main reason for upgrading to Windows 2000 Service Pack 5 is for NTFS.
Security.
NTFS 5. In other words, to have secure authentication.
So,
okay. And if your company doesn't need it, why should they be forced to upgrade to
a company with 10,000 machines doesn't need security?
Not necessarily.
They don't want a stable operating system? And I'm just saying this because if you wanted to, why wouldn't you deploy Linux?
You know what? They are.
Okay. Well, then the problem solved. If Microsoft wants to continue to do business the way Microsoft sees fit, it will. Your alternative is to deploy a separate operating system and circumvent Microsoft altogether. And that's fine. There's no argument.
Yeah,
the average user doesn't care. You and I do. You and I care. They don't.
Yeah.
All they want to do is be able to log in, check their email, maybe surf the web, and you can do that in any operating system.
And do it very well.
Yeah. I say that with no trepidation. Any operating system.
But what gives Microsoft the right?
They're a company.
No. What gives them the right to hide spyware in an EULA on a single XP machine?
Wait a minute. Wait. What are you talking about?
Okay. If you take... here, let's take another...
And I think I know what you're talking about, but I want to make sure...
Let's take another hypothetical case. Okay? If the following scenario exists, you have four Windows 2000, three Windows 98 machines, and one XP machine on a small local area network. It is possible for that single XP machine to sniff every other machine on that small local area network. Is that not true?
That's part of the operating system.
Yeah, that's part of the XP operating system.
Right.
Okay, so by putting a single machine on that LAN and clicking accept license, so you have given Microsoft permission to sniff every machine on your local area network.
So don't install an XP machine on your network.
Yeah, but the users don't know.
Oh, but a user's not going to walk into the office and install Windows XP. If they did, they'd probably be reprimanded. I mean, I've worked with IT departments before. They're not exactly the kindest people on the planet. And I say that...
Someone would fire them.
What's that?
Good way to get yourself fired.
Exactly. I mean, I've worked with plenty of people like that. They don't care. I mean, if their printer's down, they're gonna say, "Hey, wait, you know, my printer's down." But I don't think they're gonna walk into an office. What do they do at home? Let them do whatever they want at home. I mean, if you, on a home network, and some people would argue, well, the users need to understand this stuff. How is the user going to be, the average user going to be impacted by that? How? I mean, it was the same argument when Microsoft instituted their not the registration, authentication, what is it called? The word, it's not coming to me. But, like, you can only install one license of XP on one machine. Well, it wasn't that their EULA changed any. It's the fact that the way they chose to enforce it that changed. People had been agreeing to only install that operating system on an X number of machines for years. If anybody would just actually read end-user license agreements or privacy statements, a lot of this stuff could be circumvented. That is your responsibility. Some people don't want to, and some companies make it such that it's almost impossible to translate that stuff. But it's not, I don't think, because they're not putting it out there, it's the question of why they're doing it. I don't think it's because Microsoft wants to, and I'm not saying to rule the desktop in that sense, but why do they care? I mean, they care on a business level, but if it keeps happening, and people like yourself, who obviously oppose it, keep opposing it, they'll change. But telling them directly, or telling users about it, they don't care. They don't care. And like I said, you know, I'm telling you like it is. They don't care. I sat there with my dad 2 months ago arguing with him over why Outlook Express chose to save a file in a certain folder. I could not convince him that there's no way around it. He doesn't know. He doesn't care. He just wants it to work his way. When companies make decisions, and people who are in positions of power make decisions, that's when they start listening. That's when they start understanding. Only then will things change. Talking about it is an important part of that process. But talking about it from a perspective of where someone's going to understand it and want to understand it and want to know more about it. People, they don't care. If the operating system goes out and finds updates for them, great. Oh, my God. That, number one, it just made my job a lot easier. Number two, it made their life a lot easier. I mean, assuming they're not on dial-up, heaven forbid. But these types of issues we are going to care about because this is part of our industry and where it's headed. But I think with the proliferation of Linux as it continues to develop, and I think, honestly, KDE is going to catch a lot more flack in the coming years because it's a clear leader in desktop environments. And it's going to become, in my opinion, it's going to catch as much flack within the Linux community as Microsoft does.
Oh, there's no doubt about that.
The tallest nail always gets pounded, period.
Yeah.
If it wasn't Microsoft, it would be someone else.
It'd be Red Hat.
Exactly. Some people, they're zealots to the end. But having, you know, experience and dived into technology on as many levels as I have, I've got a broader view. I understand that Linux is not going to be perfect for everybody. Neither is Windows. Neither is OS X. God, the word's not coming to me again. I need another cup of coffee.
Well, I tell you, Chris, it's 10:15.
I'm sorry.
No, don't apologize.
Don't apologize, but this has been great.
It's been a very animated show. It's been a lot of fun. Let's real quickly refresh everybody's memory about Gnome Dax.
Oh, yeah. If anybody wants to argue with me or talk to me or whatever, I'll be in Iowa July 25th and 26th, Gnome Dax.
GNOMEDEX. Yeah.
.com. Registration, by the way, only $99 for a complete weekend. That includes two lunches, free Wi-Fi, and as much of the show as you can take in.
And as much of Iowa as you can take
in. Yeah, there's not much there, but that's why we're doing it out there. It's a very limited environment, and it's worked very well. Last year we had about 600 people there, and people of all shapes, sizes, colors, backgrounds, running, you know, Linux and OS X and Windows. I mean, it was great. It was a big geekathon. But it's very much, as Doc had said, it's really a people type of conference.
Yep.
Very engaging.
And if anybody, any listeners, decide to show up, make sure that you look for me on
the floor of the conference somewhere. I'll be wandering around. And if you find me, then you can tell me you're a listener of the Linux Show.
Oh, wait a minute. No, no, no. You said that if I came on the show again tonight, that you would wear a tux costume.
I never said that.
Yes, you did, Jeff.
Hold him to it. Hold his feet to the fire there, Chris.
I don't believe I ever said that.
Well, then it was your evil twin.
But I would actually probably be willing to do something goofy like that. But anybody who does come up to me at the floor of the event and says you're a TLS listener, I'll line you up a Linux Journal t-shirt. So make sure you look for me. Whether or not I'm in a tux, have you got a tux costume?
No.
Yeah, well, you can find one between now and the 24th. I might be convinced to put it on for a few hours.
The last costume I wore was a Carmen Miranda costume, and I still have a picture of it. Iowa had at one time they had a decent technology community that I was trying to help rally and you know, get going. And they had a contest where if you dressed up something tropical, you would win a Palm 7. And so I went out and I rented a Carmen Miranda costume for $20. Well, I was a clear winner. I think the most someone else went out is they bought a lei, you know, and put it around their neck. It's like, come on, people. Let's do something fun. If I can find a tux costume for you, will you wear it?
Not the whole weekend.
Will you wear it?
Yes.
All right. You know, I'm going to have a segue there at Gnome Dex.
Okay.
An actual segue. You'll be able to stand on it. I don't know if anyone's going to be able to ride it, but I've got Philip Terone coming out. He's going to have a segue.
Cool.
Anyway, so I would just like to see a penguin on a segue. I don't think I've ever seen something like that before. Anyway, I'll see if I can dig up a penguin costume for you, and you can wear it for, you know, 5 minutes. I'm just playing with you.
Well, I'm sure I could be controlled.
Chris, make him wear it all day.
I was just backing him into a corner. That's all. I was just, you know, having fun. That's all. Trying to wake everybody up out there.
Make him wear it all day.
Okay, well, we are up to 20 after the hour here on the Linux Show. This has been our extra long extended edition to make up for last week. And it's been a really good show. And we really haven't even had a chance to cover any of the 27 news stories that Russ has on the list. Russ, you still there?
Yeah. I'm fighting to stay awake because you got to remember on this coast we're starting to sneak up on midnight.
Yeah,
so,
you're almost at midnight already. Yeah,
don't make me do another hour.
You can do another hour.
I can do it all night.
Yeah.
And by the way, Mandrake is completely installed.
There you go. The IRC channel's been wondering about that.
Yes, it's happy. It's very happy. And the default setup for Mandrake 9.1, huge thumbs up. Huge thumbs up. They got it right. They finally got it right. But anyway, I'll let you guys go. Have fun.
Okay, well, thanks a lot, Chris, and good luck on Gnome Dex, and I will see you there.
Definitely. I hope to see other listeners there, too.
Okay.
Great to hear you, Chris.
Thanks.
Okay, well, as I said, it is 20 after the hour of 10 o'clock here in Chicago, and we really do need to shut the show down for the evening. And so, well, thanks, everybody. If you've been listening to the whole two-hour segment, make sure, let's see, there's still 51 of you in the IRC. The IRC topped at about 63 tonight, so I'd like some of you out there who have listened to the whole 2 hours, and especially those guys who are in the IRC like an hour and a half before the show telling me that they've been downloading 5 shows a week for the past couple months. Hey, throw a few bucks into the PayPal link to keep the Linux Show on the air. We need the support of our listeners as well as any commercial support that we can have. As I said during the show, we are looking to upgrade to a Gentner unit, and so we're looking for a major sponsor to throw a couple $1,000s our way to upgrade to regular commercial broadcasting equipment. And so if there's anybody out there who owns a computer shop or Got a software company. Please contact us at staff@thelinuxshow.com. I will have to come in a sponsor. We really do need your support. Or just go to the website, www.thelinuxshow.com. Click on the PayPal link and throw us a couple bucks. As usual, you can also email our DSL vendors. We do have a new consumer-grade DSL that has finally arrived. We filled out the paperwork with the vendor just a couple of days ago, and we're going to have consumer-grade DSL as a marketing program for the Linux Show that is going to start at about 30 bucks a month for DSL. Pretty good price. No frills, no fixed IPs, no nothing, but we do have the regular business service that we have available as well. So support us any way you can. Register a domain. But until then, make sure you tell 10 friends about The Linux Show. That's www.thelinuxshow.com. We will be back next week, right, Russ?
I sure hope so.
Okay. And do we have a guest lined up for next week's show?
Not yet.
You know what? Maybe we ought to catch up on the news.
That's an idea.
Okay, but in 2 weeks it's Larry Augustin, is it not?
Ooh, that's good. I think that's 3 weeks.
Three weeks.
I'm still trying to clear it with one of the other fellows that he's supposed to have on.
Yep.
Oh, that's great. Larry Augustin coming up. That's
Larry
great.
Larry Augustin is coming out of hiding.
Ah, he's a great guy.
And his new company, the Post VA Linux system / software / whatever. But Larry will be with us at least in a couple of weeks. But other than that, hey, we'll see you guys next week. We'll see you guys at Gnome Dex with Chris.
Although I've never been to Rio, there's something saying to me, go. 'Cause there's a chance I just might find my big romance there. Rio de Janeiro. Tomorrow I may fly to Rio to find the love I need to know. Someone is waiting for me somewhere, and it could be Rio de Janeiro.